The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
You know, when I have a trial, you know, even if it's in Tallahassee where we live, my wife makes me go stay in a hotel because she just can't tolerate my nonsense.
Jimmy Gustafson shares how he's had to deal with the stresses of trial and overcoming a mid-career slump.
And I'm like depressed, okay? You know, wondering if I've, you know, have I chosen the wrong career path? Maybe I should be a different kind of lawyer. Maybe I should do something different than what I'm doing.
And reflections on his very first tobacco trial.
My dad died from lung cancer caused by smoking. And as much as I didn't want it to be personal, that one was for him. And I really, really needed to win that case.
And the impact the Florida Justice Association has had on his career.
Just from a selfish point of view, if someone was listening to this and they didn't know if they wanted to get into it or not, I can tell you that it's a huge career mistake not to. You want to be inside that tent. You don't want to be outside that tent.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I am Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. It was losing a personal injury case in mid-career that almost made Jimmy Gustafson give up the practice of trial law. In a few minutes, you'll hear about the inspirational story that changed him and his career and the lesson he learned about true success. He is a past president of the Florida Justice Association, an Eagle founder, and winner of the John Krupnik Award. It's given for perseverance in achieving justice for an injured client. And it was that very case that he credits with giving him a renewed feeling of gratitude in being a trial lawyer. Jimmy Gustafson of Tallahassee sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in November of 2020 to share his life's journey, the rules his loving wife Josie laid down that helped, and how, through questioning himself, he's become a better lawyer.
Jimmy, you've been with the trial law legacy firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley for 18 years now, and you're the managing partner of its Tallahassee office. Your practice has focused on tobacco litigation, including fraud and conspiracy, and along the way, of course, some other product liability and negligence. Your first tobacco trial turned out to be quite a whopper right out of the gate against R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, right?
Yeah, the first one that I completed was the Horner case. Cal Warner and I had mistried a different one called Sofer earlier that summer. And so we went in late fall to Levy County and tried a case for James Casey Horner. He was the smoker, and it was his daughter, Diane Webb, and she was deaf. We had to have an interpreter during the trial, and having a deaf client can make things challenging.
Oh, wow.
But we went over there to Levy County, and one of my partners is going to go with me to try the case, and that Thursday, his mom was elderly, and she ended up on a ventilator in the hospital, and you know, you only get one mom. So I ended up going down to that trial by myself, and then my other partner, David Sales, kind of rode in on his white horse on Sunday. So we got to start on Monday, but it was the first one I ever did, and, you know, Reynolds brings... They got 30 timekeepers. They had so many lawyers. They had an RV outside the courthouse, full of federal law clerks and stuff, causing trouble for us. But it was one of those cases where the stars really lined up. as much as I wanted cigarette work to not be personal for me, and it was kind of a self-protection kind of mechanism. My dad died from lung cancer caused by smoking. And as much as I didn't want it to be personal, that one was for him. And I really, really needed to win that case. And going to Levy County is not the place where you want to go if you really got to win a case. You know, it's a rough neighborhood for plaintiffs. But the case went in great. It got better and better every day. And that's not normal in trials. There's usually ups and downs. And, you know, the goal is to win each witness and win each day and all that. That case, it just every day it got better and better. And by the end, man, they were, you could tell they were with us. And so they came back with a really big compensatory verdict. They gave twice what we asked for four. They came back with eight, which turned out to be a sad story on appeal because court kind of latched on to the fact that the jury gave more than we asked for. But then we came back for punitive damages, and they did exactly what we asked them to do in the punitive damages round, and it ended up being a $79,600,000 verdict. And it was a really cold day that day. It was the day after Veterans Day we got that verdict, and it was super cold, and it was bright and sunny, and the women that were on that jury delivered that second phase verdict, and they waited outside in the cold for 2.5 hours wanting to talk to Diane. And Diane was my client. She was deaf. She was great at reading lips and wonderful lady. And that was my introduction to Engle progeny cases and trials against cigarette companies. It's daunting work. They don't settle. That whole thing that you hear, it's all true. But, you know, the interesting thing about that is if you're dealing with a defendant that's recalcitrant, doesn't want to settle, won't settle, emotionally it's much easier. I'd much rather go try a case with no money on the table than to go in there with $3 million on the table and I wonder if I can get more than that, right?
Sure.
The Webb case was my first one. I've done a bunch since then, but Webb sticks out in my mind. And I have to be honest, that was the one I needed to win that for myself, my dad, not just the client, you know. I mean, the client was of prime importance, but there was a personal aspect to that one that was very meaningful and significant to me.
Do you think that came across to the jury, that somehow you had a passion?
I don't know. There were times when they'd look over like wanting to hear what we had to say about this. Like they were offended by what was being shown to them, and it was some horrible cigarette company misdeed, you know. And it's hard. You can't make that. You could lock plaintiff lawyers in a room for a month, and they couldn't dream up the kind of stuff that these cigarette people did. It's a dark day in civilization's history, is those companies, the rise of those companies.
Even though that case got reversed and you had to retry it, you were successful at the end. Sometimes retrials go the other way, though. You had one just this year that ended in an even bigger verdict than the original trial, right?
Yeah, that was my third retrial of a cigarette case, and the first two retrials didn't go near as well the second time as the first time. And I was, you know, wondering, you know, what's wrong with me, and I don't seem to do well with retrials, you know. And it's kind of like playing a football game. The team that won, the team that lost the first game has kind of got an advantage going into the second game. You don't want to do the same mistakes you did the first time, and, you know, you learn more in losses than wins. So on the retrials in the other two cases, I struggled a little bit. So heading into the Degnan trial earlier this year in 2020, which was a verdict that, you know, in retrospect, we snuck in before the big shutdown for the virus. And so Degnan was a case we tried back in 2015 down in St. Petersburg. And it was for a smoker. Was a young man. He was 44 when he died of lung cancer. And he had two children under the age of 25 and a wife. And we got a good verdict for that family, and a punitive damages verdict, too, against Philip Morris and Reynolds. And We got reversed on appeal, had to retry the whole thing, and we came back. And during the appeal, the widow died.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lost our main client, and so now we had the two children, but they didn't have their mom with them anymore. So it was a little bit different case going in a second time. And it turned out really well. We were able to get twice. We more than doubled what we did the first trial. So that was
That's terrific.
Yeah. It was nice for that family because you know they'd been through it twice, and lost their mom in the process. And justice does grind slowly, but we do get there if we keep our nose to the stone.
Sure. And you can't win every case.
No, you can't. I mean, you can tell yourself that, and you tend to, but you'll be disappointed.
Let's go back to the beginning. What made you want to be a lawyer, Jimmy?
There was not a watershed moment, aha moment, where I said, oh, I've got to be a lawyer. But my father was a title examiner. He shot pool with three lawyers every Saturday. And one of those lawyers, it wasn't a trial lawyer, but he was a really neat guy and very interesting. And he was the type of person that I admired and at that point in my life. And then my older brother, Lance Block, became a lawyer. And now it was kind of within reach, you know. There weren't any lawyers in my family. My grandmother was a legal secretary, but we didn't have any lawyers. So when my brother became a lawyer, now it was doable. And my brother Lance had a big impact on me in terms of my desire to become a lawyer. I was watching him and watching him be successful and feel good about helping people. And we were raised in an environment where that was valued in our family. My mom was real big on that. So I think that's how it happened, is I wanted to be a lawyer. That's how it kind of came to be.
Sure. Now, out of high school, you didn't go right into college, though. You chose the Army instead. Why?
I guess I was mature enough to know that I was too immature to go to college. And, you know, my parents didn't have a lot of money at the time. It was, you know, rough economy in the early 80s. And so I signed up for the Army. And, you know, what better place for an immature 17-year-old to run off to than a place where they're telling you what to do all the time, right?
Makes it easy.
Kind of keeps you out of trouble. And that was a great experience. You know, you go in the Army, you are on your own 2 feet. No one's going to pick you up. You got to do it yourself. And no matter what the movies are like, you know, the Army is about people that don't quit, that keep going when the going gets tough. And you do it without sleep, and you do it without food, and you do it when you're uncomfortable and freezing and wet. You make you cross streams in the middle of the night in 25-degree weather, and you wonder why in the world would I sign up for this. But the Army was a great experience for me, and the things that I learned there, I'm able to apply in my professional life and work, and just how I approach problem solving. I really learned all that stuff in the Army. I didn't learn it in law school.
So you did your gig in the Army. You went into college. You graduated with an English degree from Florida State University. Then you went right into law school at FSU with a summer at Oxford University in England. After graduation, you began your career actually on the defense side with an established firm.
I did. I did malpractice and product defense for a great, great lawyer and great person, a guy named Howard Hunter, who's down in Tampa. And Howard took a chance on me right out of school and brought me in, and I hustled and I worked hard, and I wanted to be excellent. And that was important to me. And working for someone like that who was willing to teach and willing to spend the time to make me better, I think he saw that kind of investment in the person working for him was going to pay dividends for him by, you know, me being able to handle more stuff and take some things off of his plate. And he was great about that. We're still very close to this day. We talk all the time.
So he was your first mentor?
He was my first mentor in law. Probably my second. You know, I would say my first mentor was a divorce lawyer in West Palm Beach, Florida. My best friend I mentioned was David Sales. And we run around trying these cases together. David's father was a guy named Ronnie Sales. And Ronnie was the lion of the divorce lawyers in West Palm and Palm Beach, and was a fantastic lawyer. He was a taskmaster. And that was the place that I learned how to research the law, is working for Ronnie. And Ronnie would give me assignments with deadlines that were quite tight within the day, and he was always right. And he always, every time he said there's a case that says this, and he was always right. That's how I learned how to do the research, and I did it under some pressure. So Ronnie was my first mentor, and he taught me that the practice of law is you have to be a lion. If you're in this to make money, if you're in this to get good seats at the restaurant, if you're in this to get attention or get your commercials on TV and all that, you ain't gonna make it. You will for a little while, but you won't be around for the long haul. And the way people will remember you will not be the way that you thought. But with Ronnie, our role, we are a lion, and our role is to help the people that came to us for help. That's our focus, singular. And I learned that from Ronnie. And from Howard, I learned you learn different things from people as you go along. Howard taught me how to be a lawyer, how to act like one, how to treat other people. Even if you're born into somebody, you don't have to be nasty. You don't have to treat people poorly to get your job done. Because you don't have to punch the clock at some point and go home, be around normal people that ain't trying to, destroy the other side all day long. And Howard was really good about teaching me not just to work hard and be ethical and everything, but how to treat people outside the prescriptions of our rules and things. How do you really need to be?
What prompted you to switch into plaintiff work?
I think I always was going to be a plaintiff's lawyer. I think Howard always knew I was going to be a plaintiff's lawyer. I wanted to represent people. I wanted to help people. And doing defense work, you don't get to pick who you represent. I mean, there's aspects of defense work that I think are much more difficult than plaintiff's work. It's vice versa, too. There's aspects of plaintiff's work much more difficult than defense work. But I always knew I was going to be a plaintiff's lawyer. Deposing people that are dying of cancer, and they know they're dying, and you know they're dying, and they know that you know they're dying, and here you are born into them. That's not fun. I never enjoyed doing that. I know lawyers that do, but I never did. I knew what side I needed to be on.
And your first plaintiff firm was with another very established firm as well.
Yeah, I Tom Masterson over in St. Pete. Tom and his dad Barney had firm over there. Very well regarded people. A lot of people don't know this. Barney tried the very first crashworthiness case in the United States of America. First person to ever bring a case to trial for a product defect in an automobile was Barney Masterson. And he tried it in the old St. Pete courthouse there that's now a museum. Not St. Pete, Clearwater Courthouse, which is now a museum. And the family story was that this guy named Crazy Ralph was this young lawyer who would follow Barney around. And it was Ralph Nader. And Ralph used to call Barney up and talk to him about the depositions course. The case was about a Corvair that were very unstable. You go around a corner, they'd roll over.
Oh, yeah.
Neat car, but just a death trap, you know?
Yeah, rear-wheel drive, as I recall.
That's right. Okay. And so Barney tried the first one. What's interesting is after that happened, when I worked for the Masterson firm, and Barney's son Tom was a great trial lawyer in his own right, a wonderfully decent, decent man. So when I came to the Masterson firm, Barney had passed away. And I got his office with his desk and his old computer. And this is, we didn't have Windows and all that stuff back then. I had all his DOS letters on the computer in front of me.
Wow.
And I learned a lot. And it's a little bit, he was dead by then. So I guess reading his letters wasn't so bad. I didn't send them to anybody, but I learned a lot kind of going through his shoebox.
Oh, yeah.
But I remember Barney talking about when I had a case against Tom when I was working for Howard. when I was a defense lawyer. And Barney was still around then, and I remember Barney asking me, I was a baby lawyer, and Barney asked me, how do you like your job? How do you like practicing law, you know? And he would take an interest in you.
Sure.
And I told him, I said, you know, I really like it, but it's stressful. And he shook his head and smiled, and he said, this isn't stressful. Stress is owning a fruit stand and watching your fruit rot in the sun, and nobody's buying it. Barney died at the funeral, talking about Barney's life. Well, before Barney went to law school, Barney was married to Stella. Well, I don't know how many kids he had at the time, one or two, and he owned a fruit stand.
Mm.
So he knew what he was talking about, and that stuck with me when I think about my job being stressful. I think about what it could be like.
Sure. And of course, Barney Masterson was another past president of the Florida Justice Association.
Yeah.
Florida Academy of Trial Lawyers then.
Right.
So you went to Searcy Denny. You'd been practicing there for a few years, very successful, when another significant case, Nathan Hannon, came along. And it's a case that you've previously said not only was a significant case on its own, but it was a turning point in your career. Let's start with the case, though, first. Tell us about that.
Well, Nathan Hannon was from Live Oak, Florida. My mother's from Live Oak. My family's from Madison going back six generations, but the diaspora occurred, and some of them ended up in Live Oak and Palatka and places like that. So I spent a lot of time in Live Oak in my life, and Nathan was from Live Oak. He was 15 years old, and he was an Eagle Scout, which is very young to be an Eagle Scout, and it said a lot about Nathan. And Nathan was born with a condition called hydrocephalus, where you had a buildup of cerebrospinal fluid in the ventricles of your brain. And because your skull is an enclosed space, that's very dangerous if you can't get that cerebrospinal fluid out of your skull space. So if they don't do that, the pressure will build up and build up and build up until it forces the brain out that little small foramen at the bottom of your skull where your spinal cord exits. It'll push your brain through that, and when that happens, you die. So in order to avoid that, they put a little tube in the ventricle inside your brain, and they run it under your skin, and it goes down into your abdomen where it empties into your abdomen. So your body will just kind of absorb that CSF that is drained from your brain. Shunts are man-made devices. They're known to malfunction. There's nothing inherently terrible about a shunt malfunctioning. That happens. You know, I mean, doesn't mean the product's bad, doesn't mean there was bad care if shunts malfunction. And when they malfunction, that's fluids not draining, and the pressure builds up in their head, and they get headaches, and they vomit, and they can't walk right, and then they get somnolent, and then they stop breathing. And Nathan was 15. His mom took him to the local little walk-in clinic where she worked, and the clinic sent him over to the hospital, and the clinic thought the hospital was responsible for him. The ER doctor over at the hospital thought the clinic was responsible for him. And nobody called an ambulance. Nobody could fix his shunt malfunction there. He had to go to Gainesville, see a neurosurgeon. You know, neurosurgeons in Suwannee County. And so the parents ended up driving him down there. No one told him not to. No one told him he's fixing to die. No one. I mean, there was all kinds of things that should have and could have been done that weren't. It was November 29 of 1999. His brainstem herniated while he was in his mother's arms, in the back seat of the car, driving to Gainesville. They were on I-75, and they pulled over there. Cars going by them. And they're doing CPR on their son, waiting for the helicopter. Very, very just tragic, hard story to tell in real life, you know, to a jury. A hard story to tell. And that case was a very difficult case. Had a fantastic defense lawyer on the other side, one of the best I've ever seen, and they were aggressive. It's University of Florida because they own a little clinic, and it was a four-week trial. We've been on many, many trial dockets, got bumped, and so finally in 2000, no, it was 2010, it was the beginning of 2010, it was when we tried that case, so it was, you know, 11 years after Nathan passed away. The case went in pretty good, but, you know, like every other trial, you're taking shots, and you're wondering what the jury's thinking. And I remember we were getting our sandwiches at lunchtime every day from this little deli around the corner from the courthouse. And I walked in there to get our sandwiches. And I remember the lady that handed me the sandwiches and rung me up. I'd been eating a sandwich every day for a month. And she looked at me and she knew we were closing. We had just closed. I mean, I had just closed that morning. It was lunchtime. Now the defense was going to go. And she said to me, "When you guys win today, banners are going to fly in this town."
Wow.
And I didn't know we were going to win, but we ended up winning.
She had the inside track.
She had the inside track. It was very moving because the parents had been blamed for the death of their son. And that would be a really hard burden to bear.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, the ER expert that we had was on the stand. And I remember he looked over to the jury and he told them, "These are good parents. These people are good parents." And I swear to this day, that means more to Mr. and Mrs. Hannon than anything the jury wrote down on that piece of paper. That was the second one of two. The one before that was a case against Land Rover. And we tried that Land Rover case for about 2.5 months through Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, and finished beginning of January. And then 3 weeks later, we ended up trying the Hannon case in Live Oak. And it was a stressful time for me because there were two cases I worked up, and I was going to try them with Chris Searcy, who's my senior partner, and hadn't tried any cases of Chris before. That was my first ride with him. So, you know, there's all kinds of, you get nerves and everything, and you get nerves regardless, but that made me, you know, even more nervous about it. But I remember thinking, going into those cases, well, we're going to win this one against Land Rover. If we're going to lose one, we're going to lose Hannon. And the Land Rover case went in great, and that jury wasn't out long enough to eat a ham sandwich where they poured us out. And I remember being seriously depressed after that. Turned down good money to take a verdict, and then to have you get poured out so fast like that was devastating. And then we had to turn around and go try this tough Hannon case 3 weeks later. And it caused you to have some doubts about yourself.
Yeah, now you're thinking you might lose both cases.
Right, and now I'm thinking, well, shoot, we were going to win the first one. Now we've lost the first one, and you know, what's going to happen now? And I remember I was down in West Palm Beach, and Chris Searcy and Jack Scarola go to this men's group, kind of a prayer breakfast, called The Gathering. And I'm like, depressed, okay? You know, wondering if I've, you know, have I chosen the wrong career path? Maybe I should be a different kind of lawyer. Maybe I should do something different than what I'm doing. If I can't win the cases like the Land Rover case, maybe they need someone better than me.
Wow.
Maybe I'm not the guy for this. And
that's essentially in the middle of your career, because you'd been a plaintiff attorney for, what, 10, 12 years at that point?
At that point, I've been, at that point, about 16 years I've been at it. And I was concerned about what I, you know, whether I'd made the right choice, and, you know, was I really helping people? And we go to this this prayer breakfast, and they have this guy who was a tank commander. He was a lieutenant in Iraq, and a tank platoon, I think it has 4 tanks in it. I was in light infantry. If we saw a tank, someone grab a camera and take a picture of it. We didn't have tanks. And so this guy, these 4 big Abrams tanks, and they get, the lead tank breaks down in a alleyway. And they start taking small arms fire. Well, there's 3 tanks behind the one that's broke down, and they're in an alley. They can't turn around. They started thinking about going backwards. They couldn't go backwards. Guy tells this big, long story that there's a mechanic in each tank, and the mechanic in that lead tank had to get out of the tank while they're taking small arms fire from the roofs of the buildings that surround them. And he's got to work on the tank's engine to get it running so they can get out of there, because it's going to be a matter of time before somebody shows up with an RPG or whatever, and they're all going to get smoked. And so this young guy gets out of the tank, works on the tank, and gets it running. And when he gets back in the tank, he is sobbing. and they ain't got time to talk about it. They get on their way. Lieutenant telling the story says he went to him afterwards and asked him, praised him for the heroic act that he did, but asked him why he was crying. And the guy said that, and he wasn't a religious kid growing up, but he said that that when he was outside the tank, he felt the presence of God. And the reason he was crying was because he didn't want to leave that presence.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very moving story. And I remember thinking, what the hell does that have to do with me? Like pretty much every other biblical story, somebody's got to bring it to me and tell me how it applies to me. And I asked Cersei about it, and he says, well, you know, in our tradition, in order to enter the kingdom of God, you have to be able to give up your life and everything for another.
Right.
And the reason that moved you is because that young man did that, and he got to experience the presence of God when he did it. And none of us have experienced that, but we kind of get to a little bit. We dip our toe in that pool when you leave your family and you gamble a fortune on someone else's fate when you're responsible for bringing it across the line. So the reason that story moved you is because it spoke to you for that reason. And that was a really good thing for me to hear at that time, because it gave me a different kind of motivation to keep doing what I was doing.
It was a different point of reference to what you were doing.
It was. So it was 2 weeks later, we were trying a Hannon case in Live Oak. And 4 weeks after that, somebody that made my ham and cheese sandwich every day told me banners are going to fly.
And that changed your attitude altogether.
It did. You know, the practice of law, doing what we do as plaintiff's lawyers, the lows are incredibly low, but the highs are unachievable to me in any other line of work. I cannot imagine the joy that I experience in this job when we're able to help somebody. I can't imagine feeling that in another line of work. I'm not disparaging other lines of work. I'm just saying doing what I do, it makes it worth it.
So you went from not being sure you wanted to practice law.
I went from wondering whether I was cut out for doing this kind of work to understanding that it takes all kinds to be able to do this well. I can't be Chris Searcy or Greg Barnhart. I got to be myself, and just like the rest of us. And if you know, you have to know your own limitations. And you have to be honest with yourself about those. That experience gave me the knowledge that my belief was real, and my belief in the ability to help other people, it was real, and that's what that experience did for me.
And not necessarily having to win every case.
Right. You know, because you're not going to win every case. That's silly for lawyers to talk like that. Like they're going to win every case. Don't work that way.
Well, you've certainly won many. You have had many verdicts and awards in the eight figures. You are a member of the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, which is an invitation-only group of the top 500 lawyers, American Association for Justice, American Board of Professional Liability Lawyers, American Board of Trial Advocates. The list goes on and on. Top 10 verdicts of 2010. Place and a top 100 verdicts by National Law Journal. Jimmy, what would you say is your key to success at this point in your career looking back?
Well, the people around you are always a huge part of your success. And I don't mean just professionally, but I mean personally too. I couldn't do this job if my wife Josie wasn't real strong and real independent and understood why I had to be gone and work these hours and do all this kind of stuff. she understand if she didn't understand that, that would be a hindrance to me, to my ability to do it. So you know, it starts kind of with a great home life, which I've been fortunate enough to, you know, outkick my coverage with in terms of, you know, who I married.
But there's been some adjustments there too.
Sure, always. I get really, really nervous before a trial. And you know, that nervousness I have makes me intolerant, makes me a little bit different person than I really would like to be. And that's a personal failing of mine. But when I have a trial, you know, even if it's in Tallahassee where we live, my wife makes me go stay in a hotel because she just can't tolerate my nonsense, just the way I am during the trial. And so I have to go stay in these hotels. And then when I come home, you know, it she's awesome. But, you know, when I come home, if we win, she's got me picking up the dog mess in the yard and taking out the trash and folding laundry and, you know, whatever kind of mundane chores I've been getting away with not doing for a while. I'm doing them now. But if I lose, she doesn't make me do any of that. And it's half joking, but she says, I get 3 days to feel sorry for myself if I lose. I get 3 days to feel sorry for myself, and then she wants a man again, which is healthy for me. So that's kind of the way she approaches it, and it helps me get back on my feet. And then, in your firm, I mean, if you got a bunch of, you know, sorry people working with you, you're not gonna really be able to rise above that very well. And I've been fortunate enough to have a staff that I really don't deserve. They're outstanding, and they don't always get along with each other, but they always they're always moving in the same direction. And then, you know, my law partners and stuff, they give me a lot of good ideas. And if I'm not feeling like I'm at my best, they'll help pick me up. And those things matter, especially if you're on display, so to speak. If you're a trial lawyer, you got to get up and you got to be the one talking. And that can be daunting, and especially if you're not in the right frame of mind. So having good partners to get you in that frame of mind if you're struggling is a big, big help.
Sure.
I would also say... you know, people latch on to different things that help them get better. I know that for me, if I don't work on the things that I don't like doing, I don't get any better. It's kind of like playing music. If you only play the parts that you're good at, the parts that you're not good at are always going to make you stumble. So what you need to do is work on the parts that you're not good at. And I've found that my practice is best and I feel best when I spend a good bit of time doing things that I really don't like to do. It makes me appreciate the things that I do enjoy doing.
Now, along this career path, you became involved in the Florida Justice Association. You are a past president from 2016 to 2017. You're the winner of the John Krupnik Award, which is an award for perseverance in achieving justice for an injured client. And that was for the Nathan Hannon case that you were just talking about. You're an Eagle founder for your generous support of the FJA. Many bronze, silver, gold Eagle awards. You're a frequent seminar speaker. You're an author, especially on Verdure. Jimmy, how has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
Well, all that stuff you just read off was a result of being in the Florida Justice Association, the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers. I couldn't be as successful as I am if it weren't for the things that the Florida Justice Association has done for the civil justice system. They're the keepers of the framework. You know, lawyers like me are going to come and go, but the civil justice system's always going to be here. And my hope is that the Florida Justice Association is always going to be here too, because no individual lawyer can look after a system like this by themselves, and we darn sure can't expect industry to do that. We can't expect the courts to do it, and that ain't the judge's job. The judge's job is to be judges. We can't expect the legislature to do it. All you got to do is look and see the history of what the legislature's sought to do, and that ain't helping people, that's helping industry.
How important is it to give back to the FJA, especially the foundation that focuses on the research and the education that really goes to the heart of what you're talking about there?
It's kind of like, FJA is kind of like, you know, the good guys in Game of Thrones, you know. Everybody, the White Walkers are coming. We got to have everybody. And we never have everybody. There's always people that don't want to participate. They don't want to help. They don't believe in this or that. It's always an excuse, right? There's always an excuse. And I've been fortunate enough to grow up in firms, the Masterson firm and Searcy Denny, part of the culture of those firms was to participate with FJA and to give and to make it, you know, you budget your giving every year. You're going to budget your rent. You're going to budget your malpractice insurance. You're going to budget your salaries and everything else and health insurance and all that. You got to budget your FJA giving. Because, you know, if all of us did that, then all of us would have to give less if we all participated. Just from a selfish point of view, if someone was listening to this and they didn't know if they wanted to get into it or not, I can tell you that it's a huge career mistake not to. You want to be inside that tent. You don't want to be outside that tent.
Tremendous learning experience.
Tremendous learning experience, sharing experience. You know, you're dealing with something that you haven't dealt with before. There's somebody in that organization that has not only dealt with it but done a crackerjack job, and they'll help you. And that's the beauty of the organization, is people that compete with one another are friends and selfless at it. And so in terms of my professional life, it's one of the most, if not the most, rewarding organization to be a part of.
Jimmy, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, I'd like to start by actually being remembered, right? How do you know how people are going to remember you? I would hope my wife and my son, you know, my family would remember me because they know me. You know, my dear friends, they know me. How those people remember me and how, say, you know, opposing counsel remember me or judges remember me or you know, other lawyers that I'm, you know, friendly with remember me. I want to be remembered as an honest and honorable person and a kind person who made others better around them. I'd like to be that person, you know, and that's a work in progress. And, you know, we're only as good as our next one.
Jimmy Gustafson, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thanks.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.